On This Week in Enterprise Tech, more data leaks from our favorite companies and agencies, net neutrality gets a bit of support from some big names, and we talk some serious cross-platform software solutions. Twyatt on The Set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 248, recorded July 14th, 2017. Emails from your expat.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Drobo, a family of safe, expandable, yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit drobostore.com to learn more and use the code TWIT10 to save 10% off select Drobos, including the new Drobo 5D3. And by the Amazon Aurora from AWS, a relational database engine that's compatible with MySQL and PostgreSQL, which provides up to 5 times the performance on the same hardware at a tenth of the cost. Check it out at aurora.aws.
Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your usher, your steward through the world of enterprise. But as you know, the world of enterprise is a pretty large, massive place. In order to represent it correctly, I have to pull in another expert, a master of the domain, my co-host in crime, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, sounds like you need a little pick-me-up today.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, I went to bed early. I slept soundly. I woke up, and it felt like I hadn't slept at all. And then, of course, it's a Friday. So what happens? My USB to XLR codec decides to stop working. So I'm on a iPhone-style headset, and I'm hoping it doesn't create too much background noise. It's a Friday.
That's right. And well, you look beautiful, so I think we're good to go. But of course, you know, today we have some pretty amazing topics. We're talking a little bit about saving net neutrality, and we also have a guest today who's talking storage management and cross-platform compatibility with Paragon Software. But first, of course, like we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. Well, every week I seem to report one of these, and this week WikiLeaks did not disappoint us. This week it published the 16th batch of Vault 7 leaks, and this time, instead of malware, hacking tools, and implants, this release is about the process the CIA uses to collect data from compromised smartphones. Project HiRISE is an Android app which is used for malware and that actually collects data and routes it through your SMS. HiRISE only works on Android versions 4.0 through 4.3, which is actually Android ice cream sandwich and jelly bean. But it's documented way back in December 2013, which means it's more likely that they've upgraded the system over the last several years. Another name for the tool is also called TideCheck. It does require the app to be installed somehow, either by an exploit or physically, where it gains root access to the phone. It then also acts as a SMS proxy between the compromised device and a listening port, post server. Essentially, it's a man-in-the-middle attack. Once it's once you actually send the data or a message, you can actually encrypt it and route it to anywhere you want. And so based on the binary data from this particular tool, it seems the tool could be actually used as a CIA agent-to-agent secure communication as well. I think Jason Bourne might want his TideCheck back.
Well, here's a Windows 10 update you really want to fight malware. Microsoft is adding a new ability to Windows Defender, the built-in anti-malware app that ships with Windows 10. The company has cooked up something it calls controlled folder access. Here's how it works. After you've installed the Windows 10 Fall Creators update, jump into the Settings app and head to the Windows Defender Security Center. Once you're there, you'll see the controlled folder access toggle. When you turn it on, Windows 10 will make sure that only programs it considers trustworthy can change files in protected folders. This mechanism really isn't that new. I first saw this on a Wang mainframe, for God's sakes, where you can assign separate user rights to programs instead of just to users. It's also a favorite security tweak in all the Unix variations for anything running in the background. The bottom line is to limit the scope of where applications can wander on your machine in an automated way for normal users. Well, here's hoping this kind of thing becomes the norm instead of the exception.
WTF. What is going on in technology business? I like fried chicken. I like technology. I even like Huawei. Maybe they should go together? Well, KFC and Huawei think so, and they came out with a limited edition smartphone that packs a 5.5-inch screen powered by a Snapdragon 425 with 3 gigs of RAM and 32 gigs of storage, which is expandable up to 120 gigs via micro SD, as well as a 3,020 milliamp battery and a fingerprint scanner. What makes it so limited? Well, the embossed Colonel Sanders on the back. Why are they so limited? Well, they're only making 5,000 of these things and will be released for only about $162. What do you think, Jeebert? Will it be finger-licking good?
Well, while we are on the topic of the Windows 10 Fall Creators Update, sadly, timeline and pick up where you left off isn't going to be in there. Arguably, the most interesting forthcoming Windows 10 features that Microsoft showed off at its Build Developer Conference this year were Timeline and Pick Up Where I Left Off. Timeline lets you both go back in time to recreate your prior working environments and restore open documents and files, while Pick Up While You Left Off will enable a working session to be moved between devices. For example, migrating that half-written email from your phone to your PC when you get to work. The assumption was that these features would be part of the Fall Creators Update, the next major Windows 10 update that's scheduled for around September this year. But Microsoft has now confirmed that that's not to be the case at all. Joel Belfiore, in charge of the Windows Experience and Edge Browser, tweeted that Timeline won't be in the FCU after all. Instead, it'll be included in preview builds sometime after the FCU release. Sigh. Well, here's hoping we'll be able to slide our work from one device to another, just like in science fiction, sometime in the future as Microsoft fulfills items on the Windows roadmap.
As big data trends continue, and so does the intelligent edge, computing power needs to really keep up. While researchers at MIT and Stanford might have the answer, computers today are a piece built together made of separate chips and components, sometimes adding massive amounts of latency into the interconnects. Well, imagine if you could have a chip that's stacked everything together in a nice, neat 3D package. Well, researchers have constructed a chip. Instead of relying on silicon-based devices, the chip uses carbon nanotubes, which are actually sheets of 2D graphene formed in nanocylinders, and resistive random access memory cells, a type of non-volatile memory that operates by changing the resistance of the solid dielectric material. The RRAM and carbon nanotubes are built vertically over one another, making a new, dense 3D computer architecture with interleaving layers of logic and memory. What will this do to computing? Well, it provides a very dense package of computing and storage, and essentially overcoming the bottlenecks of moving data between chips. Not only will this improve existing computing technology, but it might just create a new range of technology too.
Well, here we go again. Another breach, or maybe just a big oopsie, as Verizon customer information is exposed. Seems no one is immune to big mistakes, and this breach was reported by Zach Whitaker of Zero Day. As many as 14 million, and it's been corrected down to 6 million records of subscribers who called the phone giant's customer service in the past 6 months were found on an unprotected Amazon S3 storage server controlled by an employee of Nice Systems, a Ra'ana Israel-based company. This breach seems to have also gotten this under the skin of Ted Lieu, a Democratic congressman and computer science major who is a Verizon customer and is calling this mistake troubling. He's gone as far as requesting further investigation to make sure this never happens again. Well, Congressman Lieu, join the club. I'm also a Verizon customer and also an ex-federal employee that also got zapped by the OPM breach. I, too, would love to never have this happen again, but that's not a flavor of Kool-Aid that I'm familiar with.
I call him Professor 50 Cent, but don't let that name distract you from the passion and the genius inside this guy. Manu Prakash is best known for his Foldscope, a 50-cent microscope that folds like origami. Is it real? Well, you bet it is, with magnification and resolution good enough for imaging live individual cells, embryos, swimming bacteria, and much more. This bioengineer professor from Stanford University was able to raise $393,358 out of a $50,000 goal on Kickstarter. Well, he's at it again. Prakash has now unveiled two new low or no cost health tools, the Paperfuge and a buzz, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. The Paperfuge is a paper centrifuge made of a pair of 10 centimeter reinforced paper discs strung on a braided fish line with a wooden handle. The Paperfuge can reach up to 125,000 RPMs and separates plasma from whole blood in less than 1.5 minutes. A buzz is a web project that enlists people to record the sounds of mosquitoes with their mobile phones and upload them to a site. It then sends back species names and photographs to help identify the specimen and the probability that it's carrying a vector-borne disease or not. If nothing else, this guy is pretty clever. If only he could spread his passion and ingenuity with the rest of the world. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. But next up, we're going to get into the bites, and we're going to talk a little bit about net neutrality and its movement. But first, we couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech without the support of our fabulous sponsors, and Leo wants to tell you about them. Leo?
Can I just step in for a moment and talk about our sponsor today, Drobo. Love the Drobo. I know you love the Drobo. Everybody's used the Drobo, loves it. Drobo used to stand for, I guess it still does, Data Robotics. And I remember when they first came out, it was actually the founder created it because he had a hard drive crash, but he was running RAID, right? And he thought, well, I can't lose data. I'm on RAID. But his backup drive failed and he couldn't get his data back. He said, there's got to be a better way. He invented a better redundant storage solution. They call it Beyond RAID. And if you want to know more, actually, Steve Gibson spent some time talking about it on Security Now about might be almost a year ago now. But he was very impressed with it. It's a really cool technology that has some nice advantages over standard RAID. First of all, it's robust as heck. But when you get a Drobo array, and I have a couple of them. I have the Drobo Mini, which has four slots. I put four SSDs in there, which makes it very fast. It's connected to my computer, my iMac. That's my data drive. Super fast. But what's nice is you could put heterogeneous drives in there. So unlike RAID, where the lowest common denominator will be the smallest drive and all the drives will be that size, that's kind of how RAID works, you can do a setup with Beyond RAID where you just, you know, you get a Drobo. I have a 5-bay Drobo as well, the 5N. I just put whatever I've got. I got a couple of Western Digital Reds, and I put those in there. But I also had some other drives. And you just put them all in. It builds the array. And then the lights on the front of the Drobo are really useful. There's green lights if everything's okay, but you can watch the capacity light. You can watch it go down. And then it will show you if you're running, if you start to run out of room, it'll show you the drive you should replace. You open it up. It's easy. No tools. Slide out the drive. Put a new one, larger one in. It adds that drive. It's completely redundant. And you're back good to go. Incredible. Incredible. You never lose data because it's got great redundancy. In fact, most of the Drobos have, and I do this in all my Drobos, a slot for an M.2 accelerator card, a little flash drive. It doesn't have to be big. I think 64 gigs. But it speeds up read and writes on small files. This is the kind of thing where this is a mature company. It's been around for a few years now. They've really learned. They make great products. In fact, they just announced a brand new product, the 5D3. This is their third generation 5-bay. Direct attached storage solution. They keep adding new hardware. This is awesome. Performance up to twice as fast as the previous generation. It has dual Thunderbolt 3 ports. So you can daisy chain, right? Put one into the computer and one into whatever else you have. It's got a USB 3 Type-C port. Makes it very easy to connect to a broad variety of devices. Of course, it's got all the great flexibility, expandability, data security things I told you about. For instance, you can't lose data because even if the power goes out, it's got a little battery backup and it will finish that write. I mean, this is a really nice design. You can use the 5D3 for anything where you need a lot of capacity. Edit and store photos and videos, 5K, even workflows, no problem. Back up all your personal and business data. Of course, it's beyond RAID. Comes with a 2-year warranty. It's expandable. It's flexible. Data is safe. I love the Drobo. But go to drobostore.com and look at the whole range of Drobos. And recently, they lowered prices on almost their entire line. Plus, because you're listening to This Week in Enterprise Tech, you're going to get an extra 10% off the purchase of select Drobo models, including this new 5D3, at drobostore.com. Drobostore.com. You got to use the offer code TWIT10, TWIT10. Oh, and for a limited time, when you buy the Drobo 5D3 now at drobostore.com, you'll get a free Drobo skin while supplies last. That's drobostore.com. Use the code TWIT10. And we thank them so much for their support and for making such great hardware. I got my Drobo Mini hooked up. I got the backup going on in the 5D. Actually, I have a 5N. I have a 5D and a 5N. Got a lot of Drobos. You should too. DroboStore.com. Don't forget the offer code TWIT10. Oh, I forgot to say, now back to you. Guys, take it away.
Thanks, Leo. And thanks to Drobo for their support in This Week Enterprise Tech. So let's go ahead and jump into the bites. And so this past Wednesday, a lot of you heard, it came and went, and the whole internet-wide day of action to save net neutrality to oppose the FCC's plan to remove Title II. We had a flood of platforms, small and large, that came and went in the movement, and this included Twitter, Reddit, Netflix, Spotify, Mozilla, Amazon, Yelp, and SoundCloud, along with a vast array of online communities from every corner of the internet, gaming forums, YouTube creators, subreddits. They displayed prominent protest messages on their users, encouraging them to take action by acting on or contacting FCC as well as Congress through their tools like battleforthenet.com that make it easier for internet users to make their voices heard. So let's go over some of the movements, what actually happened on this event, and what's still happening, actually. So essentially, tens of millions of people saw the protest messages on participating websites, as well as over a million emails to Congress, over 5 million emails to Congress, and it's actually still going. They're still being delivered over time. More than 2 million comments to the FCC, which nearly tripled since back in September 2014 when they removed some of these items. Of course, there was also over 124,000 phone calls to Congress. The net neutrality hashtag trended on Facebook and Twitter. Protesters went in person to the more than 20 congressional offices, and more than 125,000 websites, people's artists, online creators all signed up to participate, as well as a bunch of celebrities, Pearl Jam, Wilco, Tim Robbins, Susan Sarandon. There was also a broad participation in every corner of the internet from online gaming communities and so on. Also, Facebook and Dropbox, the three largest internet companies, as well as Google, came out and publicly with strong statements in support of the current FCC rules. And this is pretty significant, especially since Facebook's previous opposition to certain net neutralities rules were kind of in effect. So we all know that FCC Chairman Ajit Pai appears dead on set with going forward with the proposal, and he and Commissioner Mike O'Reilly have opposed the 2015 rules, calling them antiquated and stifling to business investment. And they've both repeated stating their intent to dismantle them. Pai also admitted in a speech introducing his proposal, it would be a fight. But he also said it would be a fight to intend to win, and you know what he's going to do going forward. So Cheever, what do we expect from Pai here and his team?
Well, instead of me trying to interpret things, and this is a shout out to JJ to the 4884 who pointed this out to me the other day, I'm going to read. I'm actually just going to read. I'm not going to interpret. I'm going to read a PBS interview done by Judy Woodruff and William Brangden with the FCC chair Ajit Pai. Now, keep in mind, I am reading this. I'm not interpreting. I'm not coloring this. I don't agree. But I think we ought to give the opposing opinion a little bit of airtime. William Brangham, so you, I understand, are not a fan of these net neutrality rules from a few years ago. What is your principal concern? Ajit Pai. While I favor free and open internet, as I think most consumers do, my concern is with the particular regulations that the FCC adopted 2 years ago. They are what is called Title II regulations developed in the 1930s to regulate the Ma-Bell telephony monopoly. And my concern is that by imposing those heavy-handed economic regulations on internet service providers, big and small, we could end up de-incentivizing companies from wanting to build out internet access to a lot of parts of the country in low-income urban and rural areas, for example. And that, I think, is something that no one would benefit from. William Brangden. Is there evidence, though, that these rules have de-incentivized those companies? There are. Businesses are doing very, very well. They're spending billions on the spectrum. Ajit Pai. There is a significant evidence that investment in infrastructure has gone down since the adoption of these rules. For example, there is a study by a highly respected economist that says that among the top 12 internet service providers in terms of size, investment is down by 5.6% or several billion dollars over the last 2 years. And among smaller providers as well, just literally this week, 22 internet service providers with 1,000 customers or less told us that these Title II regulations have kept them from getting the financing that they need to build out their networks. And as they put it, these net neutrality regulations hang like a black cloud over our businesses. And so what we're trying to do going forward is figure out a way that we can preserve that free and open internet that consumers want and need and preserve that incentive to invest in the network that will ultimately benefit even more customers going forward. William Brangden, I know there is a whole group of other internet companies, Facebook, Google, Instagram, those types of companies that have said to you, these rules are not a hindrance to us. We have been able to thrive and survive under these rules. Don't change them. What do you say to them when they argue this to you? Ajit Pai. Well, two different points. First, if you look carefully, a lot of these companies don't say that they like Title II specifically, these particular regulations. What they say is that they care about the principles of free and open internet. And so I actually think there is a decent amount of common ground here. And it's just a matter of finding the appropriate legal framework to reach that common ground. But the second point I would like to make is because these companies are the best evidence of the success of the light touch regulatory framework that originated in the Clinton administration, and that's something I favor. Well, this is actually starting to get kind of long, but it boils down to there are two sides of every argument. I don't particularly agree with Ajit Pai, but I also see some of his points. I am in favor of light touch. I feel the market should drive a lot of things, but I want the government to make sure that we don't somehow or another create a giant monopoly that can do whatever they want, like we had in the days of the Ma-Bell monopoly. What do you think, Lou?
Yeah, it's interesting because even on Wednesday, I won't name any companies, but I think there's a lot of companies out there, including some ISPs, that kind of showed their, I guess, almost their hand in some sense, where they attempted to convince people that they were kind of going towards or agreeing with net neutrality, some of the net neutrality parts. But in fact, they were just kind of pushing people to think that they are. Some agree what they call a two-sided market, which basically means they want to be able to charge their customers for both internet access and the websites they actually go out and reach. And so implicitly, this means that, of course, they can essentially block websites that can't or won't pay the fees that they expect, and which would essentially limit the universe of sites that a user can access. They also said that they will be able to charge web companies for the priority access, either in the form of exemption or user data caps. And this essentially would be make it more expensive for even things like startup companies and people who are just trying to get into that, especially if they can't afford the paid prioritization. So I think that this is going to have a huge effect, I think, if they don't go back. In fact, one of the key protections from the 2015 rules was the general conduct standard. And this is just the internet is a constantly evolving technology. And it's an ecosystem. And if the rules essentially are guidelines and principles to address any additional or new threats that come over time. And it's so by design, it gives the SEC and the public a process for evolving the protections as the markets and technology evolve. So, Cheaper, is this the first thing to go? Why is it because it's too big government, or what's going on here?
You know, it's hard. You know, there's an amazing number of opinions, and you know, JJ, you know, is pointing out there's a lot of different sides to this. Ajit Pai keeps forgetting a lot of things about how overbuilt the network is and how heavy-handed some of the ISPs have been on, you know, things like throttling and all that. You know, just the very fact that, you know, a lot of consumers will go out and it'll get really, really, really slow, and they finally complain, and magically, once enough people complain, the pipes start freeing up. You know, from a consumer standpoint, that starts feeling like, wait, why didn't they do that at the beginning? Do the ISPs have too much power? Why did things like zero rating become such a big deal? It is not an easy yes or no answer. There's lots and lots of shades of gray. I personally think there needs to be some government control in there, some government oversight, but I'd really like to see the market push the direction rather than big giant knobs that the government turns and one size fits all solution. That's my biggest fear. I don't want a one size fit all solution, because the world is not one size fits all.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the problem is, especially with these rules, is that, you know, our, you know, future practices, you know, could cause harm. And to, you know, especially to any of the rules that they were intended to address, and they're not necessarily addressing anymore. And this is even a quote from the FCC. It says, our future practices could cause the type of harms our rules are intended to address. For that reason, we adopt a rule setting forth a no unreasonable interference disadvantage standard. So it almost creates a bit of uncertainty about what's allowed or what's not. In fact, you know, if you think about it, rules and technology, for especially for specific technology, they go obsolete really fast. And so and you can't always be too nebulous. Like you said, uncertainty makes investment riskier. So to me, the SEC got it right here back in net neutrality days. You know, ISPs have deep pockets and they can always find loopholes. So I think we need to find a way to help them out here. Cheebert, you know, it sounds like if the SEC goes one way, it seems like, you know, Congress might even have to weigh in here. Is it time to get the word out for how you feel?
I'm not sure. You know, I've been in government and I know how slow it can move. What I really want is things like, let's try this and say if it doesn't make a difference in 6 months, a year, whatever, that it should automatically just die and we go back. I don't think there's good answers yet. I don't think I've heard a really, really good argument either for or against. W.A. Wisp in the ISP was mentioning that he's a small ISP and he opposes net neutrality. Did I say that right? Yeah, he says he opposes net neutrality. Besides the regulatory burden being ridiculous, I want to be able to shape traffic to provide better service to my customers. So there are definitely two sides to this argument, and I don't, like I said previously, I don't want big knobs. I want little knobs that the government can use to encourage things and to try things out. And if it really doesn't work, for those rules to automatically die, so we don't have to have, you know, lots and lots of debate about things. No, it doesn't work. Sorry, let it go. So W.A. Wisp, what do you think? Should we have encouraging regulations that if they don't work, they automatically die? Who knows? What do you think, Lou?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting take. And in fact, one question back to you. I'm curious. Actually, is what do you think is the least understood issue around net neutrality? Like, if there's, you know, people understand one part of it, but they don't understand the other part, and that might be the part that we're actually getting rid of. So do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I think the most misunderstood portion is the general public has this attitude that, oh, everything should be free and open and we should have no throttling, we should have no traffic shaping. No, I'm sorry. Traffic shaping is necessary. You know, if you have someone that's doing, you know, things like streaming video. Streaming video is based on typically on UDP technology, which is a Hail Mary. Just go, throw it out there. It's the fire hose. But the problem is we might have e-commerce that's running over HTTP, which is TCP-based, which is a more polite transport technology that will back off during congestion. So there needs to be some throttling so that the people watching kitten videos don't overwhelm the people that are trying to make a living on the internet. So, yeah, we need some, and that's really, really, really misunderstood. You know, you talk to Joe, whoever off the street, and they'll always tell you, oh, throttling's bad, throttling's bad. No, throttling's good. We just need to better understand it, and people need to work with the ISPs, not automatically do knee-jerk reactions.
Right. Right. I think, you know, to me, the biggest misunderstanding is between, the difference between legal jurisdiction and that's basically created the rules of net neutrality and the rules themselves. So like, for instance, the legal jurisdiction for the rules as they stand now are known as the Title II. But it's important to remember that Title II is just the legal jurisdiction the FCC is using for the current rules and essentially the ones that. That are ban blocking, throttling papers, but they're not the rules themselves. So think of Title II as essentially the means to the end and not the end in itself. We could, however, end up in a world where the FCC uses Title II to create the net neutrality rules that actually didn't protect net neutrality. For example, the FCC could use Title II and still allow ISPs to use paid privatization or throttling. So this is an important point. Sometimes overlooked, and so we always should probably focus on what the end rules are that protect net neutrality. So there's a really great question in the chat about what can the FTC do to enforce strong net neutrality rules, just like the FCC is doing. And so the interesting thing here is that the FTC itself, they don't really have any authority here to make rules. And if there are new threats on the internet emerging, they can't really do squat. The FCC has the authority to address new anti-competitive practices, and they have engineers and experts on their team. But the FCC has that, but the FTC does not. So unlike the FCC, the FTC tries to act to correct actions, something like that, either by doing it itself or asking companies to do lawsuits. They don't always take action very well. For instance, like imagine a startup is required to pay access fees or if they don't, they'll be put at a disadvantage on the internet. And in fact, if you think about it, on average, a startup essentially launches with maybe $75,000 to about $300,000 outside funding. And to me, that's nowhere near enough amount of money to actually go and fight lawsuits against big companies like Comcast and Verizon. So, and in fact, those types of lawsuits would take you years to do. So, I think here's a philosophical question back to you, Cheever. Net neutrality, was it huge before 2015? How did we get to this point, actually? How did we actually get here?
Asleep at the wheel. Not sure how we got here. Tom Wheeler certainly had a lot to do with where we got started. Truth be told, I want to feel like it's when we started, the first company started playing the zero rating game is when people stood up and said, hey, what, huh? How come someone can go to the front of the line just by paying money? So in my opinion, that's how it started. Maybe someone in the chat room was paying a little more attention to it. I was busy trying to be an academic.
Right, right. Well, folks, I think we've kind of beat that one down. I think it's time to move on to my favorite part of the show, and that's we get to bring in the guests. But before we do that, we couldn't do this Week in Enterprise Tech without our fabulous sponsors. And, of course, Leo wants to tell you about them.
Hey, can I interrupt a little bit on this Week in Enterprise Tech? Do you mind? I just want to cut in for a moment and mention AWS and Aurora. Do you know about Amazon Aurora from Amazon Web Services? It is the powerhouse of connected databases. It's a relational database engine that's compatible with MySQL, PostgreSQL, no problem, but 5 times the performance of standard MySQL on the same hardware. When you're building the kinds of things developers want to build today, you need better tools. You need super tools. You need, for instance, a database that grows as your business grows and is easy to manage and is fast. That's Amazon Aurora from AWS. It can scale up to millions of transactions a minute. It can automatically grow your storage up to 64 terabytes if you need it. Replicate 6 copies of your data, 3 different availability zones. You never are at risk. Tolerates failures, even automatically fixes them. And, of course, continually backs up your data to S3. And Amazon RDS fully manages it all, so you don't have to. If you're already using Amazon RDS for MySQL, migrating to Amazon Aurora is simple. Just a couple of clicks of the mouse, and you're there. So what you're getting? 5 times better performance than MySQL, with the security, availability, and reliability of a commercial database. And did I mention it's all a tenth of the cost? It's a great deal. No upfront charges, no commitments. You pay for what you use. Of course, it's Amazon Web Services. Find out more at Aurora, AURORA.AWS. Aurora.AWS. Imagine what you can start building with Amazon Aurora from AWS. AURORA.AWS. And we thank Amazon Web Services for their continual support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that means I think it's time to get back to you guys.
Thanks, Leo. And, of course, thanks to AWS. So let's get to my personal favorite part of the show, and where we get to bring in a guest and they get to drop some great knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And this guest hits close to home for me and for many of us, because we already use their tools and systems and solutions to handle our storage. And I personally have used Paragon NTFS for Mac, as well as both Disk Wiper as well as Drive Copy. And they are a veteran in the ecosystem for over 22 years. Welcome Paragon Software Group to Twiat today. Mr. Tom Fedro, President, and Jim Thomas, Director of Technical Services. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Lou. Thank you. Great to be here.
Great. Thanks, guys. Thank you guys for coming. We really appreciate it. Can you guys tell the listeners at home and the viewers just a little bit about yourself and what you do at Paragon?
Well, sure. I'm running the company here in the United States, and Jim is our technical director. We've been here for about 10 years now.
Fantastic. So, you know, you don't have to tell too many people about your solutions and suites, because they do know about them. But why don't you go, if you can, just tell the folks at home a little bit about Paragon Systems, what they do, what they offer, that kind of thing.
Sure. Well, we have been in business now for 23 years. We're a global company. We've got about 300 plus folks working with us now. And, you know, our claim to fame is data management. That's what we do. We do backup and recovery, disaster recovery, a full portfolio of that. But today we're going to talk about our universal file system drivers, and look forward to getting into some details there with you. And it's exciting to see you guys already have a pretty good understanding of our products, and we're very happy to be here to go into more detail.
Absolutely. Yeah, like I said, one that really kind of hits close to home for me is the NTFS on Mac. It's just one of those issues, like when you're switching between both Windows and Mac, especially for somebody who's using Bootcamp, you want to be able to kind of maybe even edit a drive that's potentially NTFS formatted for that on Mac itself. Definitely hits close to home. What other tools do you kind of guys offer when it comes to kind of cross-platform, cross-file system tooling?
Yeah, so we've got a number of products in that space, from the NTFS for Mac software, currently at version 15, EXTFS, providing access to the Linux file system for Macs as well, EXTFS for Mac. We have EXTFS for Windows to accommodate the Windows side of the world, and HFS Plus for Windows as well. So you can mount a HFS formatted drive on Windows and have full read-write access to those volumes as well. And then We also offer a value pack, so we bundle those four file system drivers along with a NTFS and HFS Plus conversion utility, and we call that our UFSD value pack and provide lifetime upgrades for those drivers with that bundle.
Fantastic. So what kind of drove Paragon Software Group to kind of drive down this rabbit hole of cross-platform storage system compatibility?
Yes, sir. Lou, we took the red pill and we chased that rabbit. No, actually, the way we got started was really back when Windows XP came out, and it was standardized on the NTFS file system, which at that time kind of left the Windows 95 and 98 folks in somewhat of a lurch where they were all on FAT32. So there was an opportunity there to build a driver that we took. You know, at the beginning of the company 23 years ago, we had our own operating system, Paragon DOS. So we had some fantastic, and we still, to this day, some of these folks are still with us that are very strong coders at very low levels. And so this driver that we built for NTFS for Windows came out, was very successful. And at that point, we took a step back and said, this is a market. This could be a big deal, because there was a number of operating systems coming out. Linux was getting to be very popular at the time. QNX, of course, Mac. So we started putting the pieces together where, the operating systems, the file systems, and now with the chipsets where, you've got all these chip manufacturers coming out with different platforms. And to put all those three together, the communications is complex. It's hard to do. And we happen to have the expertise to do it. And so we took on the challenge to become the Rosetta Stone, if you will, the communications Rosetta Stone for these type of situations. So that's how we got started, and we're still there today and having a lot of fun.
Fantastic. So what for this particular type of technology, what are some of the applications for it?
Sure. When you look at this, it's something that we didn't realize at the beginning just how far we're going to go with it. But when you look at the enterprise space, we're in 90% of the Fortune 500 with this product. When you look at education, government, U.S. Army, U.S. Navy, just about every branch of the government is using this product. Education, Stanford University, as an example, for their dual boot systems, they've got this product. Duke, Yale, very large in the education space. But probably our biggest channel into the enterprise, as well as to the home, has been our OEM partners, where folks like if your viewers out there, if they're looking at their router right now, if you've got a Netgear router or a Belkin or an Asus, a D-Link, Linksys, any of these routers, our software's inside those. And I've got a little show and tell here. When you look at the back of this, is a high-end Netgear router. You've got the USB port here, where this is a Linux device. But at your house, you go and go out to Best Buy and you pick up your, your WD or Seagate or what have you device you want to have storage. This is going to be running HFS Plus or NTFS and Linux. And Microsoft at this time really don't play well together. So our device driver, our NTFS and HFS Plus driver, is actually embedded in the firmware of this router. So the end user doesn't have to worry about anything. It just works. That's what we're all about. So, any kind of router, we're in there. When you start looking at disk drives, for instance, going into the enterprise, Seagate, another customer of ours, shipping tens of millions of disk drives every year. Ship with our driver, so that wherever this ends up, it's going to work. Whether it's doesn't depend on the operating system, file system, what have you, it's going to work. So another application, WD, Western Digital, we're in their NAS boxes. HP printers, we're in every one of their printers that has a USB drive has our drivers in it. Tablets, when you look at some of the major players in the marketplace out there, shipping millions and millions of these devices. Again, this is an Android-based device, but, they wanted to have more storage. And when you look at these little SDSC cards nowadays, these could have 256. I mean, we've got Kingston up here with 1 terabyte on one of these things. But again, it's a Microsoft XFAT standard. Again, going to Android, there's going to be problems. That's where our driver being embedded in this device makes everything work. So those are just a few of the applications we've got. We're in cameras. We're working with, the black ops where, bad guys using laptops. We can go in there with our device drivers and find out anything they've got on their machines. I mean, there's a myriad of applications for this stuff.
Fantastic. Almost X-fatting your Android, right? I think that, the interesting thing is, why you talk about like having to apply your storage and your devices to these other applications and kind of being able to access them across platform. What are some of the challenges that you've kind of come into play when it comes to implementing some of this stuff?
Yeah, just real quick, at a high level, the biggest challenge is finding the great engineers to do this kind of development work. And that's something that over the years we've become very, very good. And we've got the best engineers in the world developing, on all these different operating systems. Like we've talked about Android, we've talked about, multiple Linux variants, Mac, QNX, all these different types of operating systems, file systems, we can go the gamut, REFS, HFS Plus, EXT 2, 3, and 4, and you combine that with the chipsets from, Qualcomm, Broadcom, Cavium, Intel, MediaTek, Marvell. It's a very, very complex group of vendors and companies that somebody's got to herd the cats, and that's what we do, and that's what I mentioned before, the Rosetta Stone. But the biggest challenge is having the right people to do it. Folks like Jim here have been with the company for 10 years, and we've got a lot more like that, like Jim, that are out there making the software work every single day, as it's a very dynamic marketplace.
Fantastic. So I think, one of the interesting, I think we talked about it in several of other shows as well. This particular cross-platform file support, does it also support, file access over network connections as well? You talked a little bit about, hardlining it to the devices and so on, but does it support kind of like network access as well?
You would want to have the driver applied to the remote device. So, It's designed to access locally attached disks, and then provides access through buffered I/O. So, if the remote device on the network has the driver either embedded into the solution or has been installed on that device, then you would be able to access the content from the dissimilar file system from the remote client.
Got it. So, one of the things that there's another system that Paragon also offers, and it's kind of a unique to the enterprise as well, is the Paragon's bare metal recovery system. Can you talk a little bit about that system and kind of what solution that provides to business and to enterprise?
Sure, absolutely. The adaptive restore capabilities allows us to restore a Windows system to dissimilar hardware. We utilize DISM to inject drivers into the restored system. We reset the HAL and enable that system to boot successfully for the first time before any other dissimilar drivers are prompted for installation. So if, for example, you have a workstation or a server has a motherboard failure, you can quickly get back up and running, moving the existing disks over to a new system, running the P2P Adjust OS wizard, injecting the necessary drivers, and getting that mission critical server back up and running temporarily. Alternatively, if the hard drive dies and you have a backup image, you can restore that backup image to dissimilar hardware, run our P2P Adjust OS wizard, and get that system up and running very quickly. That same type of technology is also leveraged to migrate a physical system over to a virtual environment. So if there's no physical hardware immediately available, we can get you up and running in a virtual machine as well.
Very cool. Now, of course, a lot of people at home, they're probably saying, okay, well, there are some other solutions out there. What's different? What make kind of sets apart Paragon solutions to some of these other ones?
Well, we've been doing this for a number of years, as was mentioned earlier. And so we're supporting operating systems as far back as Windows 2000, where some other solutions may prevent you from working with anything older than Windows 2008, Windows 8 even. So we bring a lot of diverse operating system support there on the Windows side.
And data protection, journaling, some of these things that are required, especially by large manufacturers, these are not something that our competitors are offering. So that's why we've won so many large deals.
Right. Fantastic. Well, Gbert loves using some of your tools, and he has a couple questions he wants to kind of throw out there as well.
So, guys, we love virtualization in Twyatt. But the problem is, I use a lot of Hyper-V. I use a lot of VMware. It's frustrating that I can't use the internal Hyper-V physical to virtual migration tools. So you guys mentioned a little bit about going all the way back to Windows 2000. What about other operating systems? Can I do P2V for, say, Linux? How about VSD? Technically, it's not legal, but could I do a Mac P2V? What do you say, guys?
There's a few limitations around migrating some of the other operating systems that you mentioned there, Brian. We can definitely back up and recover a Linux-based system. The end result there is the bootloader for the operating system has to be reinitialized after the recovery. We're looking to provide some additional functionality for users in that space here in the near future. But right now, reinitialization of the Windows bootloader is required. On the Mac side of things, we do have Paragon Hard Disk Manager for Mac as a current offering. And we can image and restore Mac OS X to the same or dissimilar hardware. However, when we go to virtualize that operating system, there's always a third party component necessary to unlock the necessary capabilities of launching a Mac in a virtual space.
Very cool. Hey, so we had a question in the chat room. Does SMART, obviously SMART in SATA drives, figure into some of these products? Does it make it easier? Does it make it harder? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, SMART's great for determining like the current status of a hard drive, whether it's about to fail or if it's in good health. We've developed custom solutions where SMART detection and reporting on SMART results was required. But for the most part, we typically look at other values to get hard drive information. But SMART is definitely a very useful aspect of getting hard drive details.
Okay, let's put a different hat on. You know, what about forensics? You know, I used to do a lot of work with the federal government where you needed to be able to go and do forensic copies. Can you guys also go and determine whether or not, say, a write blocker is functioning before we make an image?
Yeah, so thanks to the Universal File System driver technology, we're able to detect not only the file system that's going to be backed up, but we can analyze the contents of that file system as well. The Universal File System driver technology is licensed into forensic utilities. And it can be used in a number of ways. Through Paragon's imaging solution, we can do raw imaging. So we get a true bit-for-bit copy of the original drive. And then we can also utilize UFSD to enable larger storage where a particular file system might not have provided it for that forensic imaging solution.
Fantastic. So another question that they had is, do these systems, do they support both encryption and maybe even compressed volumes as well?
Yeah. Paragon's researching means to better support different types of encryption that might be found on hard drives. And so we're looking to enable support for things like Apple's disk encryption. And then the solutions currently work with compression, things along the lines of File Vault for Mac. Some support there as well.
Got it. So you guys wanted to talk a little bit about the UCFD architecture, and I know you kind of brought along some diagrams here. You want to go through some of that stuff?
So we've been at this for a number of years, and bringing Universal File System Driver technology to different platforms enables read and write capabilities. We also provide utilities along with those file system drivers to enable formatting, creating, and copying partitions. We can work under a number of different kernels or operating systems. You see, we typically work with iOS, Android, Linux, solutions for QNX, been supporting Windows since the inception, Mac, OS X, and then some other real-time operating systems like VxWorks, ThreadX, and Nucleus. And then we bring access to all of the most popular file systems today, being XFAT, NTFS, HFS Plus, XFS, EXT2, 3 or 4, FAT32, REFS, and there's always more to come down the road. And then the key to Paragon's file system driver technology is we're always bringing high performance. So, you know, we're never going to bring out a solution that hampers performance. You'll always find native level performance. So if we're mounting a NTFS volume under Mac, we expect the same amount of performance as if that NTFS volume was mounted under Windows. And then as the image below shows, we can take any number of file systems, whether it be NTFS, HFS+, XFAT, and embed a file system driver or install a file system driver for platforms such as Android, iOS, and bring in the necessary functionality that users really need and want.
So actually an interesting question from the chat from JJ to the 484 actually asked about the new Mac OS High Sierra preview offer the new Apple file system, the APFS. Is that something that you are going to be supporting in the future? How do, you know, does it add a level of complexity to the system? Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, happy to. Paragon's rolling out a solution for High Sierra as well. And you'll find NTFS for Mac compatible with the new OS, as well as EXTFS for Mac in the very near future. We're looking forward to Apple's release of High Sierra and are welcoming other capabilities here as they begin to roll out more in the public space, such as the new Apple file system that's due to roll out relatively soon.
Now, Paragon has some other solutions as well. You know, obviously a lot of disk solutions, cross-platform solutions, but you also have things that have to do with deployment and is there anything other that would be helpful to some small businesses, medium businesses, to try to kind of roll out their solutions? What would help them with that? What other tools and what other systems?
Yeah, we've got a great large portfolio of solutions here at Paragon. So if you're looking for managed backup, we've got protect and restore, centralized management of virtual and physical and mixed environments. You can manage everything from a single pane of glass, insight into the virtual environments, so agentless backup of virtual machines, whether it's a Mac, a Windows-based system, or a Linux system. As long as the hypervisor supports it, then we can back that up and recover them. If we're looking for individual system support, we've got the Hard Disk Manager solution and its related tools. So if you want to do partitioning, individual backup and recovery, scheduled backup and recovery, virtualization, secure disk wiping, things of that nature, hard disk manager is the way to go. And then if you're looking for just specific functionality, we've got products like Drive Copy 15 Professional, Partition Manager, and individual components and utilities to accomplish all of those tasks.
Fantastic. So, Brian actually has one other question. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, so where, you know, I'm an enterprise user, admittedly in academia, but what kinds of, you know, how are people using this? You have a tool, technician toolkit. Are people buying it for every single machine? You know, what's the typical use within IT departments that you see?
So whether people want to just create a base image of a server or a workstation so that in the event of an emergency, they can go back to a working point in time, they can use a technician license to go from system to system and create those images. If a technician is going to be working on a system, they can create an image of that system beforehand, make the necessary changes. If something goes awry, they can always restore and go back to the drawing board. And that solution is licensed on a large scale. We've got several large enterprise organizations utilizing hard disk manager technicians licenses. They use it for individual system recovery, sometimes a medium scale deployment solution, and definitely see it used heavily for disk wiping these days as well.
Right. I remember you guys actually have one more really cool product. You're able to use image multiple machines over the network. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? I used to see that in Norton, then that feature kind of went off to the side. This seems to be more of a pure mass imaging product. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, Paragon Deployment Manager, a great solution for system builders, enterprise customers, anybody that needs to deploy devices at a large scale. So we offer a multicast imaging solution, cyclic multicast deployment. So individual systems can join a deployment session at any stage of the current deployment session. They'll pick up the image midstream. As that cyclic image circles around, they'll pick up whatever portion of the image they initially missed until they have a full image. System post configuration options after deployment are available too. So we can configure the system in a number of ways as far as the drive configuration goes. The operating system can respond to an answer file for configuration. And, you know, there's also a unicast mechanism there, so we can deploy from the client side if we don't want to just push out from the server side. And, you know, I guess it was saying pre and post configuration options. So you can automatically shut down systems after a deployment session finishes, for example, look out across the deployment floor and see that all the systems have been deployed and are in a proper state. So that they can then be packaged and ready to distribute out to the user base.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we're actually running out of time, but I do want to thank you guys for coming. And like I said, you know, I've used Paragon software for years, and you have just – it's like the Swiss Army knife of tools for backup recovery and file system tools, and some really great stuff in there. I want to thank you guys for coming. You know, can you, Tom, can you tell the folks at home, the audience, where they can find you, where they can find Paragon software, and where they can read up on your solutions?
Absolutely. You can visit our website at www.paragon-software.com, or you can give us a call, 1-888-347-5462. We'd love to talk to you. And again, you know, we've spent a lot of time on UFSD today on our file system drivers, but we have a whole portfolio of backup and recovery solutions from, you know, one server in one office to thousands in offices across the country. We've got very compelling portfolio products to talk to you about. We'd love to hear from you. And in fact, I think in the chat room, we have an email available for your viewers to send to us an email, and we'll get them a full version Backup and Recovery 16 at no charge, so they can really test our product and see what it's all about. We think you'll like it.
Fantastic, and I'm sure that they would love that. Jim, Jim Thomas, Director of Technical Services, thank you so much for being on the show as well. Can you tell the people at home where they can find you and all of your work?
You can find me here at Paragon day in and day out. Happy to take calls. I'm still on the phones here, and you can reach me if you need me at jim.thomas@paragon-software.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. And, of course, the Twiat Riot appreciates you dropping some knowledge on them. It was a pleasure having you on Twiat. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the time.
Appreciate it, Luke. Thank you.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of the best dang enterprise software show, according to 9 out of 10 backup devices. Of course, folks, I want to thank my co-host in crime, who is our a tireless producer, as well as the one and the only Mr. Chiebert. Chiebert, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all your work?
Actually, first off, I'm going to fess up to the Twiat Riot. I got too aggressive on my privacy settings for Twitter, and that's why I wasn't seeing some of your tweets. My big apologies. Egg on face. Sorry. It's changed. I'm sure some of you have noticed I've been a lot more responsive on Twitter now. I am ADVNETLAB. My biggest apologies to the Twiat Riot. I will do better. Even an old codger like me can be taught lessons. Anyway, give me a yell on Twiat. I've been taking notes like crazy. And some of the tweets you've been sending me, I'm already working on. Especially with the guys at VMware, Docker. Some of the guys are helping me find a sponsor at the Microsoft Office 365 group so we can start getting some of those folks on. The power of the Twiat Army surpasses all.
Thanks, Brian. Absolutely. But, of course, folks, one thing we have to do is we have to thank you. You tune in week after week. We couldn't do this show without you. But if you want to get your enterprise goodness every week and you want to support Twiat, we want you to subscribe. We want you to make it easy. We want to make it easier for you to do that. So go out right now to twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the back episodes, all the full show notes, links to our different things, as well as names of our guests. And most importantly, next to the videos, there's those magic buttons right there. And allows you to subscribe to any format of your choice, both audio, video, HD video, and pretty much on any device of your choice, phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. Also, we want you to share Twiat. We want you to share it with your friends and family. I think they could benefit from our information as well. Of course, remember also we do this show live each and every week on Friday 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, and you can come watch us live on live.twit.tv. And as long as you're watching us live, you might as well come out and jump into our live chat room as well as irc.twit.tv. Each and every week we have amazing discussions to get some great topics and questions for our guests. So come by, visit the Twiat Riot. Don't forget as well, you follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/LouMM. That's where I post a lot of the things I'm working on, as well as I also will take show suggestions. I can always forward them on to Chiebert if he decides to muck with his Twitter session and his Twitter settings again. And also, don't forget to visit dev.office.com and, of course, graph.microsoft.io. That's where all of my work and all of the things that I'm doing in my daily job will show up there. Also, I wanted to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who support us week after week for doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. And also thank you to all the engineers at Twiat that make this show possible. And also to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi. And, of course, to our TD, Kevin, the Shark Man himself. Can you tell the show folks at home what you do at Twiat and if you're even there?
I'm here. I What do I do? I enjoy my free and open internet. Yes. For the time being.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And well, we, you know, we hope, you know, with some of these net neutrality rules, you'll come back and check out next what's on Twipe. Until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twipe.